Welcome to the Building Jerusalem podcast. My name's Stephen Neal, the pastor at Alder Bethel Church and blogger at Building Jerusalem.
And my name's Stephen Watkinson, minister at St. Luke's and St. Peter's in Rochdale and blogger at Northern Souls.
So last time we were talking about lay elders and staff elders and how that all functioned within our polity. Sam Anderson's with us again. Sam, you're about to join us as a staff worker.
That's right, yeah.
How would you see that working in a Baptist kind of polity?
Yeah, so as we were discussing before, we're trying to see things as, you know, we have church members and we have elders and we want to hold them separately. And so when you have a staff member, you know, are they a staff elder or are they a staff member? So then for myself, as I'm coming in, I'm basically coming in as a staff member. We have to think that carefully through, don't we? Because we don't want the staff to become kind of de facto elders in terms of maybe knowledge that they have that other elders don't have in the ministry life as things go. You want there to be a clear channel of communication.
What do you think you know that we don't?
Well, things could happen. You know, if you're a staff member, you might have more contact time than an elder who is working full time in a different job, and I think that's hard. And I'm not really sure that I have the answer, but this part of something we're going to have to figure out, isn't it? How you have a good communication at the same time respecting that the elders are the ones that lead and govern the church.
And I think some of that is down to having clear structures, isn't it? So
yeah.
If you're clear with the church that you are not an elder and the elders remain the ruling body, if you like, within the church, that kind of sets a tone straight away anyway.
Yeah.
And then I guess on the part of a gospel worker, what I imagine will happen, I've never been in that position, I've never been a staff worker in a church and I've never had one working for me, but I imagine you will get people coming to you and going, I don't like this, or I do like that, or whatever it is, and assuming you have a level of authority that probably goes beyond your pay grade. And therefore, I guess some of that's just going to be you saying, look, I'm not an elder, you're going to have to go and talk to the elders about that.
I think that's right, and I do expect people to say that to me, because as soon as you have someone who's employed full-time, church members do kind of almost see it through the world's eyes of a career,
yeah.
And they'll look at you and think, okay, you have more authority than someone else. Now, I might have more influence because I'm full-time and I'm seeing people more than other church members who might be in work, but we need to be clear that I don't have any more authority. And that's kind of a thing that you have to teach your congregation as you go along, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. Now, Stephen, you've been both a staff worker, I guess, and a minister who's had a worker of some sort. How do you see that relationship playing out within sort of Anglican structures?
So I think it's hard, isn't it? I think one of the things that happens, I don't even know this is particularly an Anglican thing, because I'm not sure it fits within the Anglican structures, but once you have an employed staff team, it's quite easy for it to look much more corporate, a bit like what you were just saying. And it can just feel like that corporate staff team runs the church. And therefore, if you have anything that is like an eldership or something, that feels like a sort of adjunct to what actually happens in running the church. And it's hard as well if you're employing someone who is a staff member but not an elder, but that staff member is up the front, is teaching, is running groups, is, you know, I don't think there's any problem, is to say, when you employ an admin assistant or a cleaner, no one's confused about, you know, whether they're on the eldership or not, because you've employed them. But it's confusing at the point where actually they seem to have responsibilities that you kind of think, well, that's eldership responsibilities. Now, that might be, as it sounds in your case, because to some degree you're heading in that direction,
yeah,
which is fine, isn't it, and being clear about that. I think one of the key things probably comes down to the humility of staff members. So it needs to be really clear. If they are humble, of course they may know more about what's going on day to day because they're there day to day, but if they have a humility that says, I do not set the direction, I do not, you know, I'm not the person with the responsibility for the church, that's the elders, I serve the church under their leadership and guidance. If that's really clear from that person in a humble way, I think that helps deal with a lot of the issues.
I reckon that's easier as well if the person has a very specific role. So if you are employed as the youth worker, I think most people will be going, that's fine, you're doing youth work, that's your area of responsibility. So just as now, we've got a lay member who happens to be a deacon who oversees the children's ministry. Mm. If we suddenly decide to employ her, she'd just be doing the same job and everyone would see her as having the same sort of responsibility and all the rest of it. I think it's much harder when there isn't a specific area that you've employed somebody for. So Sam isn't coming in as youth worker or evangelist, he's just coming in as a guy we're employing to do all the work that you'd expect good solid members to do, in the same way as the elders do all that same work that good solid members would be called to do. And I think that makes it harder.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think if you have a situation where someone essentially looks like a pastor, then they inevitably look like an elder, don't they?
Yes.
And I think that is hard. I'd have thought in that context it's about clarity, isn't it, about where they're at in their process.
But then I would go further, because our polity is such, so we believe every member is a minister.
Yeah.
And we've made that pretty clear throughout the church. And so when you say someone who looks like a pastor looks like an elder, but we expect the members to be doing pastoral work, and we expect the members to be doing the evangelistic work that you'd expect elders to be doing, and we would look to members to be doing Bible studies and teaching and all sorts of things in the church, that's what you'd expect them to do, because everybody is called pretty much to do everything the same as everybody else. The distinction between elders and members, I guess, is that elders set the spiritual direction for the church, whereas members don't.
So with your context, would you have a regular preacher who wasn't an elder?
Yes.
Yeah.
When I say regular, though, I mean, principally, the elders would do the preaching, but I've got to be honest, that's not a, for a biblical principle. It's mainly because our elders happen to be the guys who are mainly able to preach. But Sam coming in, not an elder, I'd have him regularly preach, no problem. We've got another guy, not an elder or a deacon, but he's capable of teaching. I would have him teaching on the teaching program, because, yeah, I mean, this is Baptist polity. You have, mm-hmm. because you believe in the priesthood of all believers, we do not have this sort of clergy lay distinction. We use lay to just mean not paid.
Yeah, no, it's just interesting, because I'd have thought part of the problem in your context would be in people's minds if they have grown up in a sort of, I don't know, especially if they've had the kind of one-man band pastor, yeah, and that exactly. kind of thing. Then someone comes along who looks like a pastor, it just looks like a two-man band.
So we've had that in our church. So our church historically was a Pentecostal church, and Pentecostal churches typically would have an eldership, but the way they would view the eldership working is you've kind of got the pastor who's kind of like a super elder, who is above the other elders, who sets
kind of
the direction.
Bishop?
Well, kind of.
kind apostle, of. Basically.
Yeah. Well, in fact, some of them
some of them do call
yeah,
it apostles.
Yeah,
and some of them do call them bishops, actually, as well.
Yeah, true, yeah.
So they, but normally it's the pastor is kind of the top guy, and the elders then kind of act as almost like a sounding board, like a theological, that they might be able to push back on stuff, but they probably couldn't, they wouldn't set the agenda, and they may, depending on how they function, they may not even have a veto over anything. Whereas in Baptist polity, we would be very, very strong on the plurality of elders. And then you get different shades of that. So in some places they talk about, sort of primus inter pares sort of thing. But the reality is most Baptists would look at that and go, that just undercuts the principle of plurality of elders. You either are plural and co-equal, or you're not. Now, you may well set one guy aside to do more of the preaching and teaching than anybody else, but that doesn't give him extra authority, extra extra power, extra ability to drive the agenda of the church. That is a plural, co-equal thing that's done among the elders as a whole.
Presumably, given what we're talking about, that can be a difficult dynamic as well. So if you have set someone apart who is the primary preacher teacher, given that there's a degree to which we set the agenda of the church by your preaching and your teaching, it's just quite, these things are just difficult dynamics to negotiate, aren't they?
But then that's one of the reasons why we would have other guys preaching and teaching.
Yeah, no, absolutely. They're all sort of examples of the same issue, aren't they? That if we, it's easy not to work in a godly way.
Yes.
When we have structures that open us up to not work in a godly way. There's a certain amount, you're right. I mean, one of the things I was thinking about how you structure it. So to my mind, there are things about who comes to what meeting and what meeting decides what and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Structurally, you can make things clear like that. But you need a kind of level of godliness, don't you, that says, I am very clearly not grasping for that because that's not my responsibility. And I am very clearly taking this responsibility because it is my responsibility. And just not having that kind of, and then not having that sort of envy, jealousy kind of thing going on that can then cause a right mess of stuff.
Yeah. So how would you see that working, Sam, whether at Bethel or take somewhere more theoretical if you want, but
yeah.
Talk about Bethel.
I think if you're talking about an elder pastor who is a staff elder, I think that is an issue for them because people will come to them primarily with their issues. I think they can do helpful things, like when someone comes to them with an issue, maybe a decision they want them to push forward, they can say, I'll chat with the other elders about that, rather than give them the impression that the buck has stopped with them. Just little helpful things in language, but as you said, Stephen, in how you set up your meetings so that the staff team doesn't become a kind of rival meeting to the eldership meeting, and in individual conversation that can be reinforced, can't it, in the way that you talk about how you're going to go about a decision. We're going to talk with the other elders about that. Even with staff members, you need to be clear with them that that's kind of how the decision making is going.
Yeah, and actually I think that's where it's gone wrong, 90% of how that happens. Because I would agree with you, whenever people come to me and say, can we do X, can we do Y, my first response is we better go and talk with the elders about that. Partly that's to cover my own back, because I don't want to get in trouble. So
when you want to go, no.
Exactly.
you want to do that with the backing of your elders.
We need plural
eldership, covering your own back.
That's right.
Yeah, that's the subtitle for a book, isn't it?
But it's true, there's an element of that. I mean, you have an eldership for two reasons. It's to protect the church from one guy dominating and basically pushing his own sinful views and his own sinful agenda on a church where it be inappropriate. But it's also to protect the guy himself from accusations that are unfair, from accusations that are false, from people insisting that he do work that is not possible for one man to accomplish. Mm. So it's a protection for the church and for the guy. So I think that's important, whereas I think when staff end up sort of overtaking elders, and when one guy ends up sort of being seen as above them, I think those two things often go in tandem.
Yeah.
Because a staff in a church where the guy is above everybody else have generally been handpicked by the guy, and they've generally come in because the guy has been around networking and the pastor's been out sort of pressing the flesh sort of thing, and some people have gone, I'll go there, and he's kind of made a decision to welcome them in, and then because they're his people who he's brought in, I think that kind of relationally ends up sort of going in that direction.
When it's kind of that, at that point the pastor's kind of acting as a CEO.
Yes.
At that point they've become quite unassailable by in any direction, and in effect they manage the staff team, so the staff team do what they wanted them to do.
Yep.
What he wants them to do. And I think that's when I was saying that elders become this kind of adjunct. They might work as a break or something like that to kind of go, oh, don't do that, don't do this. I'm just thinking though, what do you think? So when you have, it's not so much, well, maybe it is true in the UK, but in the US, you've got these kind of very well-known pastors who have huge influence, whether it's their websites or their radio shows or whatever it is.
Like this one.
Yeah, I think the laugh was right. Do you think it's even possible to make it work in that kind of context where someone is... do you know what I mean? That how are they not the first among equals?
I saw Mark Dever... It was Jonathan Lehman writing about Mark Dever, about how that works at Capitol Hill.
That's a good example, yeah.
And I think what I thought was really good about that was the thrust of the article Jonathan was writing is, here is how Mark shares authority with the elders. Here is how he makes it clear that they are plural and they're co-equal and they are all about the same business and he isn't above others. So things like, he almost never preaches at the evening service. Other elders or other members do that. He isn't always leading and chairing meetings. Other elders may do that. There are a whole host of things they did, which I thought was quite good. The one thing I didn't like about it was there seemed to be this assumption, which I think undercuts Baptist polity, actually. There seemed to be this assumption that the elders would be the ones who do all the preaching, and the elders would be the ones who would lead everything. Whereas, historically, and Dever being a church historian of Baptist polity would know this, historically, Baptists have been big on the priesthood of all believers, to the point where, and this is in contradistinction to, say, Presbyterianism and Anglicanism, where we would say anyone can baptize anyone in the church, anyone can give communion to anyone in the church, anyone who's capable of teaching scripture rightly can preach in the church, and therefore we are member managed as well. So when we bring in members, we have members meetings where people may vote on mainly election to office of deacons and elders, and mainly the admission and removal of people to membership. They're kind of the only things we vote on. But we are member managed because of the priesthood of all believers, where we don't believe you have special authority to run and manage a church. We believe everybody empowered by the Holy Spirit is capable and able, in theory, to do those things fully.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I was thinking when we were talking about, you talked about every member ministry last time. So, again, just this classic Anglican thing. So, that really exploded in Anglicanism in the sort of, I suppose, with the charismatic movement, I don't know, but in the kind of 60s and 70s, and everyone was up for every member ministry.
Yeah.
And then we've got these structures that make it really clear that we're not up for every member ministry. And it's not quite true, but. I just think within our context, there's a lot of... So we would say we were up for every member ministry, but then not have thought it through ecclesiologically and polity-wise.
How much of your ecclesiology on that issue would you say is a hangover from the Catholicism that Anglicanism came out of? Or would you say none of it?
Anglicanism is interesting and different from a lot of Reformed stuff, a lot of the other reform stuff. I would argue we are reformed, but in the sense of or the contrast would be that we the sort of Cranmer and the reforming bishops very much tried to not throw out something unless it needed to be thrown out, so they were more conservative than a lot of reformers, if that makes sense. And a lot of that was good, and it was very well intentioned because they wanted to keep people with them. And actually, within the Church of England at the time, they were pretty effective at that, I think, in a way that had you gone down a more Presbyterian route or something, that could have gone wrong. I mean, obviously, there were areas where it went wrong, Puritans, 1662, the Great Ejection, or whatever it was. With that, it's always been a bit of a debate within Anglicanism then, okay, why didn't you throw this out? Is it because it's a Catholic hangover? Is it biblical? Some people would talk about episcopacy and the way we do that, and polity and the way we do that. And it's always slightly, if you're being totally honest, it's always a bit hard to know with Anglicans whether they're kind of retrofitting the Bible to what they've already got. And I understand that as a criticism. You have to do that within your own consciousness as an Anglican to some kind of degree. You kind of go, well, if I was reading my Bible, would I come out with episcopacy? Do I think it's... And actually, the reformers would have said, no, not necessarily, but you could legitimately. So they're slightly different. So a Catholic would say, yes, it has to be episcopacy. The Anglican reformers would say, it's legitimate. And so we would say our polity is legitimate. I think that's right. I think where it falls down for us most of the time is that because the vast majority of Anglicans aren't reformed Christians, then you end up with people who are applying a polity in a Catholic way.
So I was going to say, is this pretty much a clericalism that hangs over from Catholicism? Is it a clericalism of your own creation, or would you deny that it's clericalism at all?
So I don't think it need be clericalism.
But the fact that you've got guys who you're saying you can only dole out communion if you're kind of appointed specially to do so, and you can only preach if you're specially sanctioned to do so in a particular way, and you can only be a vicar if you're sort of specially sanctioned in a particular way. How's that not clerical?
Well, so I would see that more in the sense of the good order of 1 Corinthians 14, in terms of making sure that appropriate people are doing the job. But I can also see what you're saying, that there's then within that a real easy tendency towards clericalism. I think your problem comes out, historically it's probably hard to work out exactly when and where it came from. So there's been a kind of high church Anglicanism all the time. I mean, that never really went. But it was a Protestant high church Anglicanism. But you might have found some clericalism there. Then, of course, you've got the Oxford movement. Now that's a kind of different breed of high church Anglicanism again. But in all of that, is there a Catholic-y influence? Yeah. Has it become... I mean, it's a really interesting one. That what people say is that Anglo-Catholic Oxford movement had a massive impact, but has almost died.
I incidentally got in trouble on Twitter with Richard Coles, of all people.
Okay.
Yeah. I like to tweet pictures of Anglicans in their dresses and all of that, looking like girls, and going... Especially those stupid ones that are outside buildings in their dresses with their crutches on, jumping in the air looking like prats. And basically...
Yeah, it doesn't really go with my order and dignity kind of line.
No, I don't think it goes to anyone's. But I like to tweet them and go, as a running joke, this is why the Anglican Church doesn't connect with the working classes, And I got loads of pushback, everyone making the same point over and over and over again. Oxford movement, they wore robes and they did quite well among the poor, so that was okay. Now, I think that's true historically, but as anybody who studied history will tell you, 150 years on, the culture's not the same and things are different. And just because people historically, in a culture that was broadly Christianized anyway, looked to the Anglican Church, doesn't mean that today, if you go down Fitton Hill in a flipping dress and a mitre, that someone's not going to batter you. Because
do a little experiment, couldn't we?
I would like that experiment.
I'm not sure I would. I just think it's important that causation and correlation thing are not the same thing. So Anglo-Catholics ended up in poor areas because they were persecuted initially in the Church of England, and they went to the places that no one else would go to, which were the poor areas. Now,
that's familiar.
I know. I can't think of ever mentioning that before. But now, the problem is, say some of them therefore did quite well. Now, there were specific things that they did that they thought were intentionally, so that they were trying to be very visual in all sorts of ways, from what I understand. And, fair play, they were sort of saying we're dealing with lower literacy levels. One of the reasons you might argue that it's all fallen apart a bit is that we're now such a visual culture, you don't need to go to church for your visual input. But anyway, what's happened with we've lost most of that. It was quite principled Anglo-Catholicism. I might disagree with it, but they were kind of much more orthodox than the sign of liberal side. Yes. They're kind of and what is the vast majority now of the Church of England is liberal Catholicism, and which is a kind of how that works. But so what you then have is a kind of form without much theological content, really, because it's kind of believe what you want. Now that just, like, clericalism is very important in that context, because if you've got no kind of content, your form is everything. And so, yeah, we've got shocking clericalism now, because, you know, if I don't wear anything fancy, there's nothing else that really distinguishes me.
Yeah.
And
which is interesting.
What's the point of me, kind of thing?
But that's our position. So what's the point of me?
Yeah, but well, that's not quite true, though. See, what distinguishes you at that point is your faith. So what you're saying is the group that you're being distinguished into is Christians.
Yes.
What distinguishes them is the group that they are into is clerics.
Okay.
And if they drop out of that, what are they? So it's certainly the... I don't think it's right, and I don't think it is Anglican, but certainly the Anglican, the Church of England anyway, has been very open to abuse in that direction.
Okay.
Abuse, not in the, you know, in the kind of abusing the theological yes. position.
So, to drag this back to the point of sort of staff and elders, how does that function then, given that setup, or does it not function?
So, I would say the big weakness that has been a, again, not necessarily, but has been a Catholic hangover, is that, you know, monarchical episcopacy. So, in effect, you do have one person who is the authority, the bishop, the vicar, and so forth. So, as Anglicans, where in the Free Church you've seen the one man band sort of scenario, we've almost had that enforced by the system. Now, it's not necessarily the case, because actually there's now that's freed up a lot in terms of people being licensed in different ways who aren't necessarily paid and all that kind of thing. So we can actually have a system that looks much more similar to your system. But that history tends to mean that you're always fighting against the idea that the buck stops with the vicar, which is even more difficult in a current context where you're then saying, well, the vicar is actually now a kind of manager over multiple churches and that kind of thing. So if the buck's supposed to stop with him, but, you know, he's got all these different things, and that can be really messy. I just think we're in a... I don't think it's necessarily like that, but I think the situation we tend to be in is very messy.
Yeah, so I do think our structures are a lot neater, but I do think we often mess up our own structures. So I think if we stick with biblical categories of elder and member and paid elders and paid members, then I think you don't go too far wrong. I think you get into trouble when you start creating things that don't really exist biblically.
So one of the some of the kind of conservative evangelicals within Anglicanism is say that one of the things we need to get a grip on is what we mean by all these sort of different... I mean, we sort of have that, and then we have these kind of left field things. So we do have what are kind of stipendiary ministers and non-stipendiary ministers, paid, unpaid. But then you have like lay readers or readers. Now, where exactly do they fit in the, you know, and then you have a kind of what might be thought of as a diaconate in terms of the church council or the church wardens, but it's not clear that that's necessarily where. And a number of people said along the lines of ordination as well. What do we mean by what we're doing, and who, what office, if you like, are people actually residing in? Biblically speaking, and I think that's true. I think we could do to get. I think history hasn't served us well in that, and we've just ended up with a much too messy situation that could do to be clubbed.